Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is composer and musician Ron Riddle. Riddle was educated at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. In his early years, he was a drummer percussionist for 13 different bands, ranging from symphony orchestras to opera companies to jazz and rock bands. In 1987, he became a member of the legendary hard rock band Blue Oyster Cult. He eventually began composing music for film and television and has composed over 400 scores for networks such as Discovery, National Geographic, Animal Planet, and many others. His most recent work includes scores for National Geographic's Border Wars and Discovery shows Hoarding, Buried Alive, and Megaquake, Hour That Shook Japan. Welcome to the show, Ron.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, according to your biography, you started playing drums at the age of 8. Tell us about that. How does an 8-year-old get a hold of a drum set?
Well, I was pounding on everything, I think, possible, like the coffee table. And my parents just finally put sticks and drums underneath it to make it look constructive.
Oh, really? So you were interested in rhythm as a child.
Yeah, I think I was probably pretty hyperactive, ADD.
Yeah, it's a good thing they didn't drug you. They might have destroyed all of your creativity.
It's possible.
Now, you also started your own rock bands. I heard that you started one at the age of 11. To tell us how you segued from banging on the coffee table to starting a band.
I think probably, you know, pop music had a lot to do with that, and listening to the Beatles. I think they were out by then. If not, you know, it was kind of a whole, you know, movement that was starting to happen.
Uh-huh.
And that was all really, I think, really part of it. You know, playing music and playing rock and, you know, it became kind of a gravitational pull towards that.
Uh-huh. And then were you playing drums with the bands, or did you learn other instruments?
No, I was playing drums, although I did play trumpet and some guitar at that point, too. But I've always performed, really, with drums.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember when you started composing or thinking about writing your own stuff?
It was pretty early on. We had a piano and an organ, and soon I got a set of vibraphones and, you know, just started composing these little pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really think anything of it. It was just something that I did. And now that I think back on it, it's probably very similar to what I do now, because they're very short pieces. And I mean, it would be interesting to hear them now, but I have no idea what they sounded like.
Really? You didn't save any of the...
No. The first one that I actually saved was one that I wrote at Berklee College of Music when I was there, and that was a percussion ensemble. And that was actually all written down, and I probably have it somewhere.
So you started taking your music seriously when you finally got into the music school.
Well, I always took it seriously. I think it was really the only thing that I ever found that I wanted to do. I was so adamant about that. Actually, growing up where I grew up was Dayton, Ohio, and that's the home place of, is it Jonathan Winters? Yeah.
Oh,
Jonathan Winters.
The comedian,
and,
yeah.
And where that famous criminal got jailed. But yeah, there wasn't much to do there except for, I kind of put it into two categories. The only things to do there was crime or music. And luckily, music won out.
You chose music. Well, you joined the Blue Oyster Cult in 1987. Was that a real different scene for you? I mean, they were hard rock, right? Psychedelic rock.
Well, I was always doing hard rock. That was one of the things that I always did. And I think when I play, I'm very passionate, so it ends up being pretty loud. You know, so being drawn to groups like that was not out of my comfort zone. You know, I used to listen to, you know, most of the groups in the 60s, like The Doors, Hendrix,
uh-huh.
You know, Cream. But on the other hand, there was groups that I listened to, like, well, composers,
yeah,
like Stravinsky and Bartok, you know, Miles Davis, Weather Report.
So
you know, those were kind
real...
of like my early influences.
Uh-huh.
So Blue Oyster Cult was a little more into the heavy metal genre than I frequented.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's still, it was still comfortable to me.
Uh-huh, and it fits for a drummer to be able to be versatile like that, doesn't it? Did you ever wish you had gone into classical?
Not really, no.
Because some of your compositions sound like it's, you know, obviously influenced by that.
Well, I think that what was great is I think that I had a good amount of different styles and genres, and, you know, from orchestral stuff to, you know, hard rock to,
mm-hmm.
You know,
jazz.
Jazz, mm-hmm. Things to draw on. And I think that really paid off later as a film composer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I remember being in the orchestra, like, you know, one of the orchestras playing timpani or something, and you have, there's quite a bit of space before you come in again. You know, maybe you have got like 52 measures or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used to just totally groove on all of the instruments and the sections and put my head in different places, you know, so that I could really get the feeling of that. And I think that did pay off eventually, particularly when I was doing scores that called for very traditional instruments or orchestral instruments. I knew what the articulations were. I knew how to get the sounds and combine samplers and synthesizers to actually make that work.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure being in all those different worlds has helped you because you have such an eclectic resume in regard to the compositions you've done. I want to play an excerpt from one of your works. This one's called Rainforest Canopy. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
This was from a film called Pollinators in Peril. And it was a Turner Original Productions. This was around the vicinity of, I think, 1998, 99. And the host was Peter Fonda. It was an environmental film on the rainforest, and it was environmental as far as pollinators and their disappearing and their dying off and how that was going to affect we as humans.
Okay.
That's basically what the film was about. Now, this particular scene was Peter Fonda is in an outdoor elevator in the rainforest, and it brings him up over the treetops into like the canopy, and he's able to view this whole expanse. That's what this segment is about.
Okay, well, let's listen to a little bit of it. It's really gorgeous, and it's interesting the way you segue from almost like a lilting orchestra to a little bit of peril, it sounds like. It's really, really a fascinating piece.
You know, that's I can contribute that totally to writing to picture, because that's how I write, or particularly at that time, that's how I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Things have changed a little bit, but at that point, you know, there was the whole expansive rainforest thing, and then the camera pans down on like a group of ants in the jungle, and there's jungle life, so you can hear the transition there before it does like an ending chord.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. Now I heard that you actually had to turn your back on being a rock musician because you hurt your back, and that's how you got into composing for film and television. So tell us about that. Was that hard to segue?
Yeah, the weird thing about that is I was kind of out of commission and had to be off the road for a little bit, and I sat down at a piano and started writing. And what came out was this music. You know, I hadn't written any classical music up until that point.
Mm.
And what came out was something that was sounding extremely classical. I was really sort of enthralled with it, and I stopped everything, and I only wanted to work on this piece and did that for like an entire year.
Yeah, and it turned out to be a whole opera,
a
symphony.
Yeah, it turned out to be a symphony,
uh-huh.
A programmatic, you know, that has a story line and everything that goes with it. So, but it was a little bit painful because at that point I was so into doing that much more than going on the road. You know, I would call up my friends that, you know, they wanted me to come out and, no, I'm like doing this. They'd go, what are you doing? And I'd be, well, it's just kind of this classical symphony.
That must have been a shock.
It's like, what? You know, why are you doing that?
And then you
what
eventually,
you,
you called it the journey too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Huh. So that was the beginning of you going into film and being a composer full time.
Well, what happened was that was, you know, it was very cinematic, that particular symphony. And a filmmaker in town, the late David Gluck, heard that and wanted me to work on a couple of films that he had, National Geographic films that he was doing. And I'd never worked on a film before, so I did that, and I was working on two or three at the same time, and all of a sudden it was like, wow, I love this. This is like such a great creative process.
The rest is history, I would say.
The rest is pretty much history.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about the process. You were talking about you composed to film. So I've been wondering about that. Do you see a script? Do you see a finished film that you put music to after it's already completed? To tell us about the process.
Scripts I don't use very much. I do get them, and filmmakers like to get them to me. But I think my strong suit is really looking at the images, looking at what's captured on film, and it's almost like uncovering what I feel is there anyway.
Yeah.
I have this belief, kind of it's fun, but I have a belief that when I look at a piece of footage, or there's a particular cue, which is called, that the music is actually already there. And it's just a matter of uncovering it, like an archaeological dig or something.
So you're trying to excavate the emotions
that
you need to convey with the music.
And when you look at a piece of footage, you know, it'll have a certain rhythm to it. It'll have its own voice that's in there somewhere. So it's just a matter of uncovering that, you know, and there's clues along the way, like how the camera's panning, or what the emotional feeling is of the scene.
Mm-hmm. How much do producers tell you what to do, though? I mean, are they involved in the process? Do they say, oh, no, Ron, this is a little too melodramatic?
Each one's different. And usually a producer will check in and will have some sort of input. It just depends on the filmmaker and the producers how much they like to do that. Some really like to be hands-on. Others like to leave it a little more up to the composer to come up with something.
Mm-hmm.
It is a collaborative process. It's a service gig in the way that if they're not happy with the end result, I'm not really either, because it really takes that whole, you know, and that's the whole point of it.
Do you get to keep the copyright on the music, or does it belong to the filmmaker?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because when I started out, I was headstrong about keeping my rights on everything. And I was able to keep my rights on probably about 99% of everything that I scored.
Wow.
Which is really unusual and almost unheard of. Today, that's extremely hard to accomplish. You know, I'm not able to pull that off for the most part today, because all of these companies have wised up, and they realize that music publishing really is, you know, there's money involved. So
Exactly. They
want to keep that money.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ron Riddle. He's a composer of film and documentaries. Now, I want to play another excerpt. This one's called Decoding Nostradamus. This is a really, really mysterious kind of piece. Tell us about it.
Well, this is a film on Nostradamus that was a BBC film. And it had some great, like, British actors in it, and it was wonderful. I was able to, like, score right to the drama and right to the acting.
Mm.
This particular scene starts out, Nostradamus is in the 15... It takes place in the 1500s. So it's a period piece the way it starts out, and it starts out with a view of a castle and then goes to the interior shot of Catherine de Medici's bedroom, where she is having a nightmare. And she's having a nightmare about King Henry. She's having a nightmare about him being killed in a jousting match. And the great thing about this particular score was I was able to use voices. And I took Nostradamus's quatrains and translated them into Latin, then had voices sing them. And then I was able to thread that into the score. And you'll be able to hear that probably about two-thirds of the way through this particular cut.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to it. It is really beautiful. That is really a gorgeous piece. I love the voices. They sound like Gregorian chants to me in some ways.
Yeah.
Now, how much time do you actually get? Does it vary from producer to producer? Do you quickly have to turn something over?
It's usually about a full score being like an hour film, which typically has about 40 minutes of music in it. I usually get as low as a week to 10 days to 2 weeks to do the entire thing, which is the writing, arranging, recording, mixing, and mastering of the entire thing. And that's going back and forth with the producers and the editors and any sort of, cuts they have that, have changed the picture as well. Uh-huh. So it's extremely tight deadline, and I usually don't get any sleep during the whole process.
Do you work well under that kind of pressure? You must.
Yeah, I guess I do.
Okay, so this is remarkable to me. When you first arrived at the studio, you told us that you do all the instruments yourself, you do all the music yourself. I was sure that you were using orchestras. How do you do that?
Well, mainly I have to do that because there really isn't time to get anyone else involved. But if I did get other people involved or an orchestra involved or that kind of thing, or started writing the thing out to give parts to people, it would be another week or two or who knows what. And in the world that I compose in, that kind of time period isn't really allowed. They really want it like yesterday. Hmm. And so I've put more of my energy into very high-end samplers and high-end, musical instruments and synthesizers and things that I can perform myself to be able to get that effect.
I see. God, it's remarkable to me. Now, people often talk about craft and technique in regard to people's talents, especially with music. So with this kind of a turnover, how do you find time for inspiration?
You don't have time for inspiration.
Really? So you wouldn't say that?
one of the beautiful things is you don't have time for writer's block.
Or inspiration.
Right. You just have to, the gun goes off and there's the finish line right up ahead and you just have to go for it.
So do you ever long to just do a Ron Riddle piece that you can use inspiration with instead of something commercial for someone else's creativity?
I think that I did that with the symphony, and that took really about a year and a half to finish. And in a way, that's a beautiful experience, and there's nothing like it. But it also just takes too long.
Ah.
There's something about having to have the gun pointed at your head and say right, and you're off. You have to come up with the goods.
And you work well under pressure. See that ADD thing that we were talking about earlier on?
That's paid off.
It's a good thing they didn't take it away from you. Now let's play another excerpt before we run out of time. This one's called Chase Down. It's from Border Wars.
Right, right.
To talk to us a little bit about it.
Well, I've just finished like 6 seasons of Border Wars. I've been doing that particular series for the last 4 years. The great thing about this series, it's a total study in tension. How to build tension, how to sustain it, and how to make it pay off, like at the very end with, hitting the listener over the head with everything you have.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts out very minimal and just grows and grows and grows. And I don't know how many cues I've done for National Geographic like this, but, it's a great opportunity to learn how to do that kind of a thing. So that's what really this piece does.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of it.
Thank you.
you can feel the tension in it when you know that there's something building up. Something's going to happen in this. It's really interesting. How much do you think music is instrumental, so to speak, in a project being successful?
Well, this kind of music, and it's so interesting because this kind of music, I kind of call it the music that is always present but seldom heard. People don't really notice the music. What they notice is, you know, all of a sudden their heartbeat's getting faster. Maybe their palms are getting sweaty. They can't really seem to turn the channel.
But I find music really instrumental in films.
Yes.
Like I told you, I love soundtracks.
So you listen to the music.
I listen to the sound, you know, Black Hawk Down, all these, Thelma and Louise. And there wasn't a lot of music in that, but the music was memorable.
Well, you're probably one of the few people that actually hear the music as it's, you know, going down in the film. And actually, good film music, that's what really it's supposed to do. It's supposed to blend. In fact, I really find that I know when a cue is finished or a piece of music is finished is when it disappears into the background of the film when I'm working on it.
Uh-huh.
So it becomes all the elements. So it's an interesting thing.
Have you ever had a composition rejected by a producer?
Sure.
And so what do you do with it? Just reverts back to you, or do you use it for other things?
I use it for
other things. Or do you just throw it away?
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things that you can always use. It's not like it's going to be a bad piece of music.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subjective view on what maybe the producer wanted there or didn't want there. And, music is the thing that conveys and really tells the audience how they should feel there, where they should feel it.
Exactly.
You know, that type of thing. So maybe the producer didn't want it there or didn't want them feeling that particular type of thing, because it can be, you know, it can go so many different ways.
Yeah, yeah. There is a lot of talk now that they use too much music in film. They use it as segues. Some people say it's lazy. And instead of having a story to tell, you just put in music, you know? Have you heard that as well?
I have heard that. And it's certainly, you know, film and television has certainly changed a lot in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I started out, maybe I was doing 10 to 20, 20 to 40 cues in a film, and now there could be like 300 cues in a film. And also the pace of everything has gotten so fast that if an editor has a piece of music in for 8 seconds, that's almost too much. Like people start getting bored, or he thinks people start getting, you know, that's a trend now. So,
yeah, it is. It's attention span problem.
Yeah, it really is. It kind of says a lot about us as a society and our attention span. You know?
Oh, yeah, that's remarkable to think about that. Probably if you go back and listen to some old films or see some old films, you'll go, why isn't there any music in there?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's slow. Things are, you know, much slower and, you know, much deeper. You know, a listener can go deeper in, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. That is interesting. Now, we do have time for one more excerpt. This one's called The Itch. And then this is different than some of your other work. Tell us about it.
This is from a film called The Great Siberian Grizzlies, and it was on Discovery. It's a blue-chip film, which means it was, you know, extremely high-quality film. And it was filmed in Kamchatka in Russia. And this particular scene is bears. It's a montage of bears scratching their butts on trees.
Oh, great. Well, let's listen to a bit of it. That's great. It is different than some of your other stuff. Was that a fun one to compose?
It was way fun to compose. And I love doing those kind, you know.
Uh-huh. The different kinds of things. You have worked with so many animals.
Yeah.
And you're an animal lover, I take it, right?
I am. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about the timber wolf that you brought up and made part of your family?
I actually think he's he was instrumental in me being a film composer because my wife and I rescued him from the SPCA years ago, 17 years ago, when they didn't have a no-kill policy and they were going to kill him within 24 hours. So we felt like we had to rescue him. And my livelihood was going on the road at that point. And what, you know, we really didn't have a clue. What we realized was that I couldn't really go anywhere. We were bound together.
Yeah, you guys became a real pack, right?
Yeah, as a pack. And I really wasn't able to go anywhere anymore. You know, it was like 15 years before I was able to leave my house.
And his name was Chance.
Chance, right. So that's a perfect ingredient for being a film composer in one way, that you can't leave something. You have to lock yourself in. I wasn't able to, like, you know, cave and go, you know, play on the road or go with a different band or that kind of thing. I really had to be committed to, you know, working at home and making this, you know, film career work.
Yeah, because of Chance. That is so great. And poor little Chance died, right?
Yeah, he did about 2 years ago.
And there's a great YouTube film that you have up.
Oh, thank you.
With Chance and you and your wife, the little pack. That's really great. Now, we only have a minute left. Can you give anybody tips on inspiration for aspiring composers? Anything you would tell people?
I think the best thing to do is just follow your heart. You have to do what you really want to do, and hopefully you'll be able to sync that up to what other people want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's really the only way that I've been able to work. So I would just suggest, you know, it's a combination of really hard work, incredible dedication, you know, doing it really all the time almost, and making the connections. You know, you got to do that. You got to get out there and be known and self-promote.
Yeah.
And probably a little bit of luck, you know, mixed in with that.
Yeah. Can you give some contact information before we go?
Contact?
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
My email is ron.riddle@gmail.com. My website is ronriddle.com, which needs a little bit of updating right now. I think it only goes to about 2004 at the moment. But you can get an email to me if you would like to talk or, you know, send me something.
That's great. Well, Ron Riddle, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.